Hey everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. What can be more exciting than watching evolution at work? I mean, not the one that drags on for eons, but the one that takes place before our very own eyes every day. It's no secret that the space industry is in full steam at the moment. Where the direction is headed is not clear yet. If I had to commit myself, then at least upward, I should say. In this episode, we have the CEO of the South African space agency, SANSA, with us.
So currently my day job, essentially, is to look at the strategic perspectives of the South African National Space Program. So that's what I do.
SANSA is a comparatively young agency, and that's what makes it so exciting, because it reflects all the issues that more and more countries are facing every day. How and in what way not to lose the connection to and in space? The space scene is becoming more and more competitive, which pushes prices down and subtly gives state players opportunities that no one would have dared to dream of a few years ago. But these technologies come at a price. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you Val Moonsamy with his gripping insight into a world that is already making everything look like yesterday. Okay. So, what is the main focus of SANSA? The main goal that you're working towards?
So, I think to answer that question, it would be important to go back to the genesis of when SANSA was actually established. So how this came about is when this intention to establish SANSA was put on the table, we started to engage different government departments. So at that time, there was about 30 to 40 government departments. And what we did was we realized that government departments were using satellite information for making decisions, like policy decisions about the environment, about agriculture, and so on. And so we asked them, if we were to establish a space agency, what would you want from this agency? And of the 30 or so government departments that attended those kind of workshops, this was around about 2007. What we did is we clustered those specific responses, and we came up with three clusters. Focus on natural resources and the environment. So your environmental issues, whether it's the oceans or the inland, the agriculture focus or water, and so on. And then the second cluster was health, safety, and from a safety and security perspective, disaster risk management, movement of assets, all of that kind of fell under that cluster. And then the third one was innovation and economic growth. So the key focus of the agency, coming back to when it was actually established, was to actually respond to the needs of government. And in so doing, we could then look at the socioeconomic issues of the country. So even right now, for example, the sustainable development goals become very key in that context. So that's the primary focus of the agency.
Is this also a response to a global movement, a global development, a global need that governments are taking advantage of orbital surveillance — is not the proper terminology, observation, I should rather say — to develop an edge over others, perhaps, or to develop an edge over an ever-growing complexity in a globalized world? So is that a natural response from your end?
Yeah, I think the idea, Marcus, is not to essentially beat the crowd. The idea is to ensure a certain level of independence, let's put it that way. Because if we go out in the open market and say, we can get this kind of data from the open market, we can procure this data, we're not guaranteed about the integrity of the data, for example. So in certain instances, it's best to have your own satellite operations or missions, for that matter. And the kind of examples I can give you, I think in 2017, we had a tropical storm that was coming through on the East Coast coming from Mozambique onwards into South Africa. And we knew that it had a devastating effect from what we saw happening in Mozambique with heavy flooding and so on. But it dissipated by the time it came to South Africa. There was some level of flooding. But we had tasked some of the international service providers to give us access to the data from the satellite missions. And the data came about a week later, and it was full of clubs. So the relevance in terms of responding in a timely fashion becomes a problem, especially when you're asking a foreign service provider to toss the satellites for your priorities. That becomes very difficult. So having your own satellites on hand would be very crucial in those kind of situations. We also, from that perspective, looking at mining potentials, looking at what the resource potentials look like. It's also important to have ensure the integrity of the data. How do some foreign nations know what's happening in your oceans or in your backyard? Because they have the capabilities to do so. If you don't have that capability, then you fall to the behest of those. I mean, we've seen that in other countries. Foreign multinationals come in with that kind of information or intelligence, and then they start to buy off a certain resource. So you need to be able to protect against those kind of things. So having that sovereign capability is also very crucial. So it's not about a Me Too strategy in terms of what others are doing and then we need to do the same. It's about ensuring the integrity of what we're trying to do and understanding what resources we have at hand. And that comes back again to the sustainability of the issue, the environment. And then any government, there's two key priorities that we have to focus on, quality of lives and economic growth, the socioeconomic issues. And then the third one is the sustainability issues. So you can only do that by having your own capabilities.
What kind of technology are we talking about here? Is that full-scale satellites or what kind of gear are you launching into space?
We've got a satellite mission on the go that's looking, for example, at transponder signals coming from ships along our coastline. So we have a coastline which is about 3,200 kilometers long. And our economic zone goes 200 nautical miles into the ocean. So how do you safeguard your resources in that economic zone? You cannot do that by ship or on the ocean itself. The only way you can do this is by satellites. So what we're doing is with this new mission, there's three more satellites that are going up in the first quarter of next year, which will then allow us to form a constellation of satellites so we get more frequent coverage in terms of the ship signals. So what we've done is we now understand the transponder signals coming from the ship along the coastline, and then we overlay that with radar data, satellite radar data. And then we can see by doing the overlay where there is a ship but no transponder signal. Okay. And now you can...
What would that mean?
That would mean things like illegal fishing or smuggling activities. So we picked up, for example, a ship that was traveling without a transponder from South America to the east coast of South Africa. And when the ship was confronted, it's those kind of things. And illegal fisheries that's happening on our coastline. So now we can pick up those kind of activities from satellite machines. So those are the kind of applications that we are looking for. In terms of utility, agriculture, providing information, that there's valuable information in the satellite sensors that we cannot see with the naked eye in the infrared and so on. And that gives you a sense of the cell structures, the amount of water content in the plant and so on. So you can use that kind of information for precision farming as an example.
So you can determine the water content of your crop, of your plants from orbit.
Yes, you can. So we have an application. So because South Africa is a water scarce country in a way, so the usage of water is even regulated in South Africa. So a farmer must document how much of kiloliters of water they're actually using in their farm. And they have to then submit that on a regular basis. We can verify if that is true or not using satellite imagery. And there's been instances where we have contested what the farmer was saying using the satellite imagery. And there's so many different applications. So that's just on remote sensing. Things like global navigation satellite services, we don't necessarily have our own navigation satellites. We use the GPS or the GLONASS or the Galileo's missions. But what we have done is built a satellite-based augmentation system here in Southern Africa. And we've worked with some international partners. So essentially, if you're looking at GPS as an example, your error signal could be as much as 5 to 10 meters out. Okay. Whereas with the satellite-based augmentation system, which is correcting for those kind of signals that are coming from those satellites, you can bring the accuracy down to within the meter. Now, that's very important, especially in places like Africa, like South Africa. There's a lot of what we call informal settlements, so people that build up shacks. And you want to know where each dwelling is and how many families are in each dwelling from a statistics point of view. And now, because you don't have post office addresses, you can give a geolocation for each dwelling.
Okay.
But you don't want every signal that's more than 5 to 10 meters. Because then you're going into your neighbor's house. The error signal is too great. So now you can, within a meter, accurately pinpoint where each dwelling is. And that's important for the post office, as an example, when they want to deliver something to these settlements. And so you make those kind of applications a reality. Even COVID-19, when you're tracking now cases around COVID-19 and social distancing issues, how do you do that if your error signal is more than 5 to 10 meters? If I'm using my cell phone to track, now I can correct that to within a meter, so I can figure out how many people that came within the meter to me if I had COVID-19. It's those kind of applications that can become a reality. So it's looking at those applications. There's quite a few things that we're working on the satellite missions. We do have lined up a big pot of funding that we're going to look at about half a dozen satellites or so that's going to go up in the next 3 to 4 years. And then we're also revamping the entire space value chain. So what we are building is a digital, let's call it data cube platform. So this was actually built by Australia, the Geosciences Australia, as a prototyping mission, an operational mission. So we're building what is called a digital Earth South Africa. So it's a data cube, and I'll explain what that is. But there's also a similar initiative called Digital Earth Africa. And in fact, coincidentally, I just signed off on a hosting agreement for Digital Earth Africa this afternoon. So we'll be making an announcement. But the whole idea of data cube, so we've got data, satellite data that goes back to 1972. Okay. If you want to know what happened at any point in the country, and if you had to go into that archive and have to process that data to figure out how that landscape has changed over time, that can take you anywhere between 3 to 6 months to do the full process. So what the data cube does is it pre-processes the data and it stacks it into a high-performance sort of cloud cluster. Now, if you want to interrogate the system and figure out what has happened over that same landscape, you can do it in under 3 hours as opposed to 3 to 6 months. Wow. Well, that becomes quite critical if government is looking for a particular answer to a question, a policy-related question. They can then come with their question into the system, and then the system will start to provide the information they're looking for. So just to give you an example, this was a use case in Australia. Here's a water body, which has got the quality of the water is very poor, right? And then they look at this from a satellite perspective, and they map it. And then they say, okay, we need to now make policy decisions. And they impose the policy decisions, and then they check. Has it made a difference? And immediately you can see the quality of the water has changed. So it's using it more or less, I want to say real-time
feedback.
Yeah, exactly. To figure out what's happening on the ground. So it's almost like now casting as opposed to forecasting.
Fascinating. What was the most surprising use case or result or learning to you personally from that kind of observation?
Yeah. So the kind of things that we look at, you know, when you're looking at it, especially in a developing country context, rapid developments happening all of a sudden overnight. So you could get a housing settlement just cropping up all of a sudden. Okay. And so now there's applications that have been developed that can tell you and analyze as to whether this is an informal settlement or it's a proper construction site. Okay. So now you can deal with the issue almost instantly, you know, from a regulatory point of view, because it's much more difficult to deal with a problem if there's a big delay. So you want to deal with the problems decisively. And that application was developed locally as an example. We had a situation, I think about 2 years ago, in one of the settlements, there was a guy who said, this is my house and it's been here for 3 months. And we checked in the satellite imagery. He wasn't there even 2 weeks ago. You know, you figure out the utility of this thing in difficult circumstances as well. So, you know, those are the kind of surprising use cases that we pick up now and again.
Fascinating. I mean, like on the one hand, I find it highly fascinating when it comes to the technological potential. On the other hand, I think it's also a challenge when it comes to privacy. And how do you deal with this? Because one could assume that we are being watched 24/7. We are being observed 24/7. So how do we deal with that?
That is a very difficult issue. So I think, in fact, in July this year, this month actually, the 1st of July, we had a new regulations come to play called the POPI Act, Protection of Personal Information. Even as an agency, as SANSA, as a space agency, we have to protect the details of individuals, as an example. So we cannot declare private information, in a sense, in the public domain. But obviously, the state has a responsibility from a security point of view, because you want to get as much intelligence to proactively deal with issues before they go out of control. And you've seen what happened in South Africa, as an example. The signals were there, but the intelligence wasn't coming quickly enough to provide that kind of information on the ground. But when you go back and look retrospectively into like social media, now you can pick up, and I think in South Africa, we're looking at a whole series of people that have been instigating the situation on the ground, and now they drop because then now the law is after that. But you can start to track some of these things in real time if you had that sort of capability. So whether you have to balance between personal protection and protection of the state at some point in time, and that's the difficulty. And I think it's the same situation in every country at the moment.
Sure. The usual claim or response you get is that science and technology are not taking sides. They are just doing their thing to bring about ever more potent and useful and efficient technologies. What is being done with that kind of technology is not their responsibility. So that's the one side of this debate. So I completely understand that this is a huge challenge to any kind of national space agency, and not only. If we widen the scope a little and go beyond the boundaries of South Africa, would you say that there are blank spots on the globe still, or is the globe already being observed 24/7 wherever you look?
I think, first of all, the globe is being observed 24/7 at the moment, but I still think there's still a long way to go, because if you look at the satellite missions, when you look at the sensors, there's only a certain choice of sensors that's out there in the satellite missions that are currently operational. And if you really want to make sense of what's happening on the ground, you need a suite of sensors. And I think that's the game is in terms of filling those gaps in terms of competitiveness. Mm-hmm. So for example, when we're looking at our satellite missions, we're getting access to, let's say, the European Sentinel missions. Why do we want to go and duplicate those particular missions? Why don't we complement those missions, as an example? So yes, the answer is yes, but there's still a lot more, because when you work in different parts of the, what we call the electromagnetic spectrum, you get different information, okay? Different sets of information coming from different domains, essentially. So we want to get as much information using as many different sensors as possible on the same observation point. And that's the key challenge, is how do you overlay and stack different sets of data to make sense as to what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're aiming for. The second thing I should mention, the use of artificial intelligence and big data is really creeping up into the applications domain, because the kind of applications that I've just put to you just now. So for example, we call a lot of these things change detection. Okay. So for example, a satellite is in a sun synchronous orbit, meaning that it will come through at the same time every day. So if it comes through at 9 o'clock today, it'll be back here at 9 o'clock tomorrow and so on. So now you can take snapshots on a daily basis if you're looking at the same observation area. Mm-hmm. And you can pick up if there's any changes in the environment. Okay. Mm-hmm. But as opposed to looking at the data physically, you can now throw this into artificial intelligence at it. And now you can automate any changes or detection of any changes. So now you're bringing those kind of tools, which making it easier to analyze the data. And I think some of the missions that are going up at the moment, and we are looking at one of those missions at the moment, is to actually embed artificial intelligence in the satellite itself, as opposed to getting the data and exposing that to artificial intelligence. And that's where we're moving. So we're looking at machine-to-machine communication. So the satellites are actually talking to each other in orbit. And they're starting to reprogram themselves as they're going through different areas, viewpoints on the earth. So that's the kind of new technologies that are coming up as well. So, yeah, that's where we're looking at.
How does that feel to you personally? Because I could imagine, on the one hand, it's a fascinating evolution we're observing here. On the other, I could imagine that this could also bear some potential challenges when it comes to potential threats from technology itself. I'm not saying that we are building up a surveillance dome. So let's leave that to science fiction for the time being, but maybe not for next year. So how do you feel about that personally?
So I think there's two ways of answering that question, Mark. So the one is to look at it from a governance perspective. So one of the things that we're looking at inside the agency, I mean, we have a board that overlooks from a governance perspective. Mm-hmm. But one of the committees is looking at social and ethics issues. Are we socially and ethically responsible? And even in Europe, we'd be looking at things like integrated reporting. How do you balance the environment, sustainability issue, and governance? It's called ESG, essentially. And that's the kind of approach you need to take to become socially and ethically responsible. Okay, so that's on the one side. Mm-hmm. So we have to be careful that we don't start stepping over the boundaries. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, maybe looking at it more from a technology point of view, you have to ask yourself the question, how much do we actually know about our environment? Is there anything more that we can learn? I'm always stunned by, if I take astronomy as an example, when astronomers say we only understand 5% of the universe, there's 95% that we don't understand. And the same applies here on Earth, is we can only see what we see. But now if you stack other data sets, can we get other insights that we would not normally see? And this is where artificial intelligence come in, because now you do machine learning and there's this whole idea of what is called serendipity. So I don't know what I don't know. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what the artificial intelligence network and the machine learning sort of systems, artificial intelligence is essentially looking for nonlinear relationships in the environment. Things that you and I can't necessarily just relate to, but it picks up and extracts patterns that's happening in the environment. And that's primarily why the prime focus of artificial intelligence is looking at nonlinear dynamics in anything that you want to observe, whether it's the environment, people's behavior, or whatever. So you can learn stuff from artificial intelligence that you'll probably take much longer to figure out, just using modern day theories and theoretical constructs and so on. So that's, I think, the utilities. When you look at things like climate change, issues on the ground around water, is there sets of information that if you put them together, you now start to pick up? And I think we're only starting to scratch the surface when we're looking at satellite data at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're getting into the domain of big data, machine learning, and so on. but we're not quite there. So that's the flip side, is what is the potential benefit of it? But yes, that we have the other side of concerns around, are we being socially and ethically moral responsible? So you have to balance those two.
Sure, sure. But time again, we observe that technology, the evolution of technology is speeding up and speeding away from our cultural evolution of political systems and structures. And that's the challenge we're confronted with, to keep up with the pace of a technological evolution when it comes to policymaking. And I think this could be a huge challenge.
No, exactly. It's the evolution also cuts at a cultural level as well, because very often your own policy landscape is shaped by the culture on the ground as well. Mm-hmm. And now you've just opened up the boundaries. There's essentially no boundaries at the moment, because communications is free flowing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It doesn't matter whether it's coming from the country next door or from Europe or from the US, it's present. Sure. So we've broken down the communications barriers, essentially. We still have some challenges in Africa in terms of broadband accessibility. Mm-hmm. But I think even there, that's growing quite significantly because there's a huge demand. So now you have these different cultural, these diverse cultures, now they're just blending together. And from a policy perspective, what does it mean? Different value systems now emerging. How do you navigate all of that? And are we going to find a new value system that's more globally orientated? I think we need to head that way, but I'm not sure how easy that would be, especially given the current political climates that we're currently observing in the conflicts and so on. So that's going to be highly difficult. But I think
maybe artificial intelligence can help us here and provide answers.
Yeah, that sounds like a move.
Absolutely. Val, in the Make Scene magazine on the Make Scene website, it's a place for tinkering. I found a detailed instruction guide to build a small CubeSat. So that means space technology is becoming ever more available for anyone in society and not restricted to nations or to bigger corporations. So would I be able to launch a small CubeSat with your services, or would you have restrictions for that?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. So on the CubeSat side, just to give you a perspective, in South Africa, we started in one of the universities a CubeSat program with sort of 30 sort of graduate students coming through and being trained on the CubeSat. And the idea was that the CubeSat are quite easy. It's quite modular, and you can then pack all sort of learning experience around the CubeSat. And then you can start launching operational CubeSat mission, which we have done in South Africa. So it's much more easier to get your expertise wrapped up in a CubeSat mission than a bigger small set or a bigger satellite mission, which is much more complex. So the accessibility in terms of ease of the use of technology, and then also the cost competitiveness of working on a CubeSat, makes it really affordable for countries to put up these missions. So that's on the one side. And the one thing I need to point out is that you find that many countries, once they've launched a CubeSat into space, they suddenly get a sense that they are space enabled, which is far from the truth, because it takes a lot from having a CubeSat in orbit to become space enabled. But to your question, if you look at the United Nations, they have treaties and conventions. Okay. And essentially, if you look at the Outer Space Treaty as an example, now these are not binding in any way, but they are guidelines in terms of how we should be responsible actors when it comes to operation of space assets. But essentially what the Outer Space Treaty says, it's the state who is responsible for any liabilities. So even if a private company or a university, let's say in South Africa, decide they're going to launch a satellite, they have to seek permission from the state and get a license to launch that satellite, because it's regulated in South Africa. So you can't just go out and launch a satellite. It's not allowed. So you have to apply for a license, and that there's rigorous testing as to the safety and if there's any liability that the state will be exposed to if anything goes wrong. Or if your satellite knocks into another satellite what would the liabilities look like? So it is regulated. Mm-hmm. So you can do it, but you have to go through the regulatory folks to be able to do that.
Yeah. And then that's, of course, attached to a certain price tag, and that restricts certain, that doesn't make it possible for anyone to do it, I guess.
Yes. So, for example, if you're a private entity and you wanted to launch a CubeSat, that satellite has to be insured. And sometimes the insurance can mm-hmm. be quite hefty. Yeah.
So if I wanted to observe my neighbor just for observing sake and build my own CubeSat for that, that wouldn't be possible so easily, I guess.
No, it won't. It won't. I think it's also very important that we somehow have rules of the road, because you don't mm-hmm. want, and that's a big problem that's happening right now, is space debris and space traffic. So we look mm-hmm. at space traffic management. At the moment, we've got about 3,000 operational satellites, but the next few years is going to be phenomenal, because we're looking at tens of thousands of satellites. We're looking at about 40,000 mm-hmm. satellites. And what would that look like? Potential for collisions in space. Is space going to be a dangerous place to be in? Protecting your assets and so on. Yeah.
But seriously, who's taking care of all this? Because, I mean, like, South Africa is not the only place to launch small sets, to launch CubeSats. So, I mean, like, there is a large number of nations and countries on the globe who are in pretty much doing the same thing.
There's a certain aspect, because of regulations, that you have to look at. So even, in the ideal, if you want to launch a satellite, apart from getting the permission at the local level, at the national level, you also have to register with the UN body as well. The UN mm-hmm. COPIUS, or UN Office for Outer Space Affairs. Okay. You have to register your space object, and then you also have to go across to the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, because now you're going to be using certain parts of the spectrum. And you have to make sure that your satellite is not going to interfere with any other satellites that's already in orbit. And you have to, there's a whole process around. Those are things that, you know, with all the regulatory hurdles that you have to go through, could be a hindrance, but not to say that it's impossible. It can be done. There are many private companies that actually go through these kind of processes. But mm-hmm. it's not as simple, cheap exercise, if I can put it that way. So you have to get through the regulatory legislation, but also the UN treaties and conventions, and then there's ITU on the other mm-hmm. side. And then you have to demonstrate mm-hmm. that you have the ability to actually operate the satellite, so, mm-hmm. which is another issue mm-hmm. altogether.
Mm-hmm. How much on average does it cost to launch a CubeSat into orbit?
CubeSat is not very expensive, to be honest, because I think the going price at the moment is something like $20,000 per kilogram to get mm-hmm. a kilogram into space. Roughly that.
So if I wanted to get a kilogram of sugar into space, that's 20,000, or a kilogram of hardware, that's 20,000. So there's no difference.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So a CubeSat is not, I think we had a 3U CubeSat, which is about roughly just under 3 kilograms. So yeah, that's what you mm-hmm. pull.
Who do you launch with, or do you have your own launching abilities and facilities?
Okay, so that's a big part of our history. So apparently, mm-hmm. so we achieved our democracy in 1994. But before that, there used to be this mm-hmm. apartheid regime. But mm-hmm. the space program back then was highly focused on military applications. So where mm-hmm. we are today is more from a civilian point of view. It's not military.
Okay.
So in the military era, the focus was on reconnaissance and looking at intelligence mm-hmm. from the ground. So back then they actually developed, because there was a lot of sanctions imposed against South Africa back in the day. Mm-hmm. So they felt it was necessary to build the launch capabilities. So South Africa has a launch pad as an example. But the expertise and the capabilities for launch capabilities does exist in the country. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think about in March this year, there was a university that launched a sounding rocket that went up to 18 kilometers, and that was mm-hmm. breaking the African record for a launch. Mm-hmm. The ones that I was talking about, that's called a sounding rocket. The ones that I talked about in the previous regime, there were 3 successful launches from South Africa. I think it was the late 1980s, 89, 88. Okay. So at the moment, there's a look and see as to whether this is something we should be looking at. So the department, the government department, is supporting one of the universities through graduate programs, engineering students. And these are the students that built that sounding rocket, essentially. So there's a seemingly an intention to consider whether this is something we should look into, because we have our own facilities, isn't it? But that's still going through its own feasibility stage at the moment. Mm-hmm. So we don't completely have our own launch capability. So we go out into the international market to look for rides. So we've practically all of the missions, we've used the Soyuz rocket at the moment, but we are looking at other options just to see what we can get access to, like SpaceX and even Israel. We have a few launch vehicles.
Is the geographical location of any particular benefit to any kind of orbital launches?
Yes. So low Earth orbit from South Africa would be absolutely great. So it's actually on the edge of a coastline. And when you launch, you go south. So it's actually quite ideal for, and it was actually placed there for that particular reason. So there's a geographic advantage in terms of launching from South Africa, definitely.
So looking a little more into the future, will we see any South African astronauts at some point?
That is a very good question. And again, that's about prioritizing and balancing budgets, because sending an astronaut to space is not a cheap exercise. It could cost about $18 million. The entire
ride. 80, that is.
Sorry?
80 million.
$80 million.
Wow.
That's roughly the price tag.
All right. So we cannot multiply the kilogram per person times 20,000, that is. So there's a little bit on top.
Yeah, there's a lot on top, because you have to do the training and go through all of those kind of protocols and so on before you even put a person on the rocket.
Is that something that is to be considered, or that is of no interest because it is just a completely different alley to go down and has no real benefit other than laurels for certain politicians and decision makers to be also now amongst the spacefaring nations?
Yeah. Look, just to put that into perspective, we do have one South African astronaut, but he paid himself. It was Mark Shuttleworth. He was very much like Elon Musk coming out of the IT domain, made the billions and then paid for themselves to go. So we do have a South African astronaut, but I think what we're looking at more from a maybe governmental perspective to look at something like this. What I can say, that there is huge value in having an astronaut from South Africa, because from a social perspective, it would be a huge plus. When you look at this country like South Africa, we've got the diversity is just phenomenal. If you look at the different race groups and even inside the race groups, there's all sorts of different ethnic orientations. And so the diversity is extremely rich. And the one thing that you look for in the diversity is social integration. And what brings social integration is these kind of events. I know when Nelson Mandela took over, one of the biggest thing that happened just as we were getting our democracy in 95 is winning the Rugby World Cup as an example. And everybody's excited that South Africa has now won the World Cup. It's those kind of events that kind of unite you. And so having a South African astronaut and launching a satellite, it's a huge statement for the country. And these are the things that kind of pull us together and make us proud as a nation. And yeah, and so it would have a huge value, utility. But I think also from a space awareness point of view, it would just put us on a different platform.
Where do you see the international space industry headed these days? Because it seems like we are amidst an ever accelerating space race. On this time, not a political one like it used to be back in the day, but this time a more economic from one. So how do you see that?
Yeah, so I think you got to segment the global space sector in a way, because if you look at it from a developing country's perspective, there's a big focus on using space technology for realizing or leveraging specific benefits on the ground, whether it's social, economic, or dealing with sustainability issues. Mm-hmm. But I think the bigger agencies with bigger budgets and pockets are looking at, for example, space exploration, going to the moon, going to the Mars. And so we claim on the more on the space applications benefits point of view, but we're starting to get a leg on the other side as well in many respects. And I can explain that just now. That's essentially the way the world is moving. And there's a lot more focus on space exploration, but there's also a bit of geopolitics in that domain as well, as to who gets to Mars first and who does what and who does get to the moon first. And so,
sure.
Yeah. So the geopolitics is also pushing the competitive edge as well between countries to get their first specific missions and so on. But that said, with all of these missions that are coming through, if you look at even the Apollo missions and the interplanetary missions, you have to look at it from a sort of a spin-off perspective. I know, for example, NASA publishes a book every year with all of the intellectual properties that have been developed through their various programs and how it's used in other industries, like diapers or baby food that came out of the astronaut program, cordless drills, measuring your temperature without any contact. Those are innovations that came out of the space program. So as much as you're pushing the boundary and it's very expensive on that end, but the utility and the value proposition back into other sectors is also very significant. And it's spurred new industries as well. And that's where we want to get to as well. It's becoming more competitive, more innovative, and pushing the boundaries. And that's how you get. So that's where the whole world is moving. And the space exploration seems to be the big ticket item at the moment. And yeah, and from a South African point of view, I must admit that the geographic advantage plays to us. So for example, if you look at any launch that happens from, let's say, the US or the European Space Agency is launching an Ariane mission from French Guiana, if you look at the trajectory of those rockets, when they come over Africa, we are the only ones that can see it on the African continent. They lose contact with the launch vehicle. So guess what? We start, maybe unbeknown to many people, is we part of that mission. We've done missions for NASA going to Mars. We supported that. Even it's not commonly known, when the earlier Apollo missions happened, there were three ground stations, deep space networks. There was one in Australia, one in South Africa, one in Goldstone in the US. Because as the Earth rotates, you want to see talk to the particular probe. So South Africa was involved in the pre-missions for Apollo, as an example. And the interesting thing is we have a conversation with NASA to host now the fourth deep space network in South Africa for the lunar and the Mars missions. So we've already got a ground segment in South Africa. And we're busy preparing that at the moment. So that's supporting lunar and the Mars missions going forward. So in a way, we're getting involved in the space exploration side as well. The one big project that we're currently doing at the moment is building a completely new space weather center. So one of the interesting things is there's a new set of regulations. Many people don't know this, for the aviation sector. So I think this came about in 2019, November. So if you're an aircraft pilot, you have to now, as part of your flight plan, file space weather information into your flight plan or take that into account. So we know we get information around the terrestrial weather, whether it's going to be stormy and so on. But you also need information as to what's happening out in space. And the reason why...
Like solar storms.
Exactly, yeah. So we need to know whether there's a solar storm or coronal mass ejection that's coming towards the Earth, because those kind of events have an impact on aviation safety. So for example, the pilot is flying using global navigation satellite services, satellites as an example. So during these active events, you get a lot of radiation in the ionosphere and the signal gets attenuated. So there's no signal. So you're flying blind, essentially. Okay, so that's the one effect. The second effect is your pilot in the cockpit is talking to the ground signal. As they're flying, they get into different sectors. But if you understand how that communication works, there's a pilot on the plane itself. They're actually transmitting a signal which gets bounced off the ionosphere and reflected back down, and it goes into the ground signal. But what happens when you have excessive radiation? and the ionosphere, that signal gets absorbed. And so effectively, the pilot is unable to talk to the ground signal. So you get what is called a communications blackout. So the pilot cannot talk. It doesn't know where he or she's flying. And then the third aspect is radiation. You get excessive doses of radiation, which kills off the cells. So there are many instances where flights have been grounded when there's been these solar storms happen. In fact, there was a few days last week, there was a big solar storm, but luckily it was facing away from on the back end of the sun. If that came through to us, the experts say we would have had a huge problem with blackouts and navigation satellites and so on. So now it's, so that information, the space weather information, so we're building a 24/7 facility. It's a completely new building at the moment, which will then provide that kind of information to all flights in Africa. Any flight coming from outside of Africa or flying from Africa elsewhere, that information will come from the space agency. So those are the big projects that we're looking at the moment that we're building up.
Fascinating. Space weather. I mean, this produces already an impression to a lay audience, maybe, that is, that space is getting ever closer to our everyday lives, because now we have, I don't know, beach weather, we have skiing weather, now we have space weather. I like that. Yeah, so this is getting ever closer to everyday experiences. Val, towards the end of our podcast, we have a fun tradition, and that is, and this podcast as a cafe podcast, and it's a coffee place, so to say, a digital coffee place. So now let's have an espresso for the mind. So you're free to share anything you would like to share with me, with the audience, when it comes to inspiration, when it comes to anything you would like to share about space, about science, whatever you feel like could be a little bit or a piece of inspiration for our listeners.
So maybe if I can put this on the table, Mark. So we are involved in the space sector, and not because it's easy, but because it's difficult. But because it's difficult, when you achieve the wins that you have, it makes it all the more worthwhile and satisfying. Right. So it's a profession that's highly satisfying, because if you're building a satellite and you're seeing this satellite flying in orbit, and it's a wow factor.
And you get to see the data.
You get to see the data. And as much as I am now more in the sort of executive function, looking at it from a management strategic perspective, there are days when I yearn to go back and get my hands dirty on the science. Because for me, that's where I started off, and it's thrilling. It's not routine, because every day there's something exciting. You're sifting through data, you're trying to make sense of it. Now you can throw artificial intelligence at it, and you get so much more insight into what's happening around our world, and that in itself is also very satisfying. So I think this is across the world. Space is one of those domains that really attract the interest of our youth. And we've seen that here in South Africa as well. We engage around 25,000-30,000 students on an annual basis who come through and want to learn more about space. And you can see the eyes light up. So for me, this is one of those domains that's hugely exciting. And all I can say and encourage young students, explore what's available in space. And by the way, when I actually reflect on my own trajectory, the one thing that hits me is that space is multidisciplinary. When I started off the science background, as a researcher, as a physicist, and then I moved into what is called the regulatory space, understanding the regulations around the space. And then I moved into looking after international relations, bilateral agreements, other countries, implementation of big projects at a bilateral level. And then I came into the policy strategy space, developing national space strategy policies and so on. Mm-hmm. And now you come to an agency. And if you think about the job that I'm doing, you have to be able to talk to your scientists. You have to know how to deal with regulations. You have to be able to engage at the international level in terms of international bilateral agreements. You have to understand the policies and strategies, and now you have to implement them. So if you think about it, space is not only about engineers or scientists. There's lawyers, there's social scientists involved in this. We have technical people that look after our infrastructure. So there's diverse career opportunities that one can get into. Space law is an example. So it's multidisciplinary and it takes a huge group of people coming together with different disciplines and backgrounds to make this happen. So look forward for those opportunities as well. And it is exciting to be part of a bigger team.
Wonderful. Val, it was so great talking with you and really inspiring. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Marcus. This was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Do you remember what the decoding of the human genome cost in the early 2000s, let alone the effort that went into it? We are experiencing something similar in space travel these days. I mean, 20,000 euros for 1 kilogram is now a lot of money indeed, but not astronomical. And let a few years pass and the orders of magnitude will fall here too, I guess. Thank you for being part of this fascinating journey we're luckily allowed to witness in our lifetimes. I look forward to next time. Stay with us.